Donnie Rader, whatever his name is, that fellow right there. I've just had a great time this weekend. Look forward to tomorrow as well. But it's always just such a pleasure to be with Donnie. We share so many good stories. He's got a bunch of them, and I got one or two myself. So it's just a wonderful thing to be with him. And I must tell you, I genuinely love him and appreciate him. And you are very fortunate to have him here with you, I will tell you. Tonight, we're going to talk about archaeology and the Bible, but we're going to talk about the New Testament aspect of it. And I want to spend a moment doing a little bit of rehearsing from last night, a couple of things we said last evening. First of all, we talked about the word archaeology, and we said it's from the word archaios in Greek, which means old stuff, ancient stuff. And the word logos, which means word or study. It's the study of ancient things. It's a science that's devoted to the recovery of the remains of ancient civilizations. So it has been called the handmaid of history. Handmaid of history. Archaeology deals with real history. That's important. And why is it important? Because it has absolutely nothing to do with things like fairy tales and fables and myths and legends and fictional stories. Those kinds of incidents that are merely figments of human imagination, none of them leave any material remains. Much of the biblical narrative could never be proven, of course, by archaeology. It is beyond proving since it lies in the domain of faith and does not lie in that area. So that if God did something, I can never know that God actually did it in terms of proving it by an archaeological investigation. However, I might be able to create, by the study of archaeological things, the atmosphere wherein I could judge a given story, whether I could tell whether that story could be real, I could tell whether it actually described the kinds of things that might actually occur, and I could provide an atmosphere that would say, well, this is not something that is a fable. It couldn't be. It couldn't be a myth and it couldn't be a legend because of the fact that I know from what I am able to ascertain from the archaeological proofs, the evidences that are found there, that this is something that surely could be so, that surely did happen. Some of the things that are talked about in the Bible are things of such a historical nature, as we talked about some last night. Some of the kings, let's say, of the Assyrians and the Babylonians and others. These are kings that are well known from history. They're known from the Bible, but they're also known from the narratives of history and the materials that have been uncovered down through the many, many centuries wherein archaeology has done work. And the ancient Near East, as they call it, or the Middle East of our day, is an area wherein tremendous numbers of archaeological expeditions have gone to explore places like Babylon and Nineveh and places like Jerusalem, or as we talked about last night, the city of Sodom and various other places that are there in the Bible, but there are also places that can still be visited today, and we can ascertain something of what actually happened there. And we can see, for example, if the Bible says that the Israelites went and captured so-and-so city and they burned it to the ground, there ought to be somewhere there in the ground the ashes of a burn layer. That makes sense, doesn't it? Somewhere in those layer upon layer upon layer of that sandwiched history that is archaeology, there ought to be a layer there somewhere where the place burned down. If the whole city was torched, there ought to be evidence of it. And so that sort of thing creates, if you will, an atmosphere that says, this is believable. It's not fairy tales. It's real. And so the evidence, I believe, is true in the Old Testament, as we showed last night. But tonight, we're going to talk about the New Testament and how that is also so in regard to the New Testament. Now, what's interesting here is that when it comes to this sort of thing, a lot of the discoveries are incidental to the biblical narrative itself. And I mean by that, these are not significant things that are just earth-shaking. They're not the kind of thing, if they're discovered, that someone would immediately call that to mind and say, oh, I see, the Bible is true because of that. Or the Bible is false because I didn't find that. No, you won't have much that is like that. But what you will find is a lot of little incidental things that create this atmosphere of believability, of veracity, of historical reality. And none of that other stuff that is so often believed by so many of the so-called elite educated class of our time. I want to start with one, the so-called Pilate inscription. Years ago, lots of scholars questioned the actual existence of a man who was a Roman governor by the name of Pontius Pilate. He was the procurator who ordered Jesus' crucifixion. You remember him in the Bible narratives. Well, in June of 1961, Italian archaeologists led by Dr. Antonio Frova were excavating in an ancient Roman amphitheater near Caesar, near Caesarea on the sea, which is called Caesarea Maritima or Caesarea Maritima, depending upon the way you want to translate it or quote it, say it. He uncovered a very interesting limestone block. On the face is a monumental inscription, which is part of a larger dedication to Tiberius Caesar, which clearly says that it was from one Pontius Pilatus, Pontius Pilate, prefect of Judea. Now, this is the only known occurrence of the name Pontius Pilate in any ancient inscription. Visitors to Caesarea's theater today visit there, and I saw that myself. There is a replica there. And the original is, of course, in the Israel Museum in Jerusalem. And you also can go to Jerusalem and visit that site, and you'll be able to see the Pontius Pilate exhibition. It's interesting as well that there have been, since that time, 13 bronze coins that were found that were struck from the year 29 to 32 in Palestine by one Pontius Pilate. This is the amphitheater where that was discovered. And this is the one that they put up there. It's not the original. The original, again, is in the museum, as it would, of course, have to be. And you can see and probably even read the fact that it says Tiberium at the top. And the rest of it, of course, includes the name of Pontius Pilate. And here is just one series of three of those coins from the years 29 to 31 that have the name of Pontius Pilate on them. A crucified man. As you know, Jesus of Nazareth was crucified. Critics used to doubt that Jesus was ever literally nailed to a cross, insisting that John's gospel was indulging in some form of fantasy rather than facing the facts in making such a claim. In the year 1968, at a suburb of northern Jerusalem, the ossuary of one fellow whose name was Yohanan, and by the way, the word Yohanan is the Hebrew word for John, Yohanan, Ha-Galgol. This fellow's name was Yohanan ben Ha-Galgol. That's even hard for me to say. While otherwise unknown, in other words, we don't know who this guy is. We wouldn't know him from anybody. But this man had been crucified. As the 7-inch iron spike still transfixing his heel bones offers mute testimony of that fact. Now, this is just an interesting, it's obvious that the nail was driven in his heel between the ligament and the bone, and you can see how it was bent over, apparently to hold him onto the cross. And as time went by, of course, the flesh rotted away, and even the wood rotted away. But here's left a crucified heel of a fellow. Here is a different picture of a couple of those, and you can see the same sort of thing. And so it's become well known now that people were crucified, and there's really no argument about it any longer. And a rock-cut tomb, such as Jesus was put into in the Bible, a good number of such tombs from the time of Jesus have been, in fact, discovered around the city of Jerusalem over the years. And so the burial practices of the day can now be described with some amount of accuracy. And for example, we can begin to see why exactly Jesus was buried in the fashion in which he was, and what the ultimate plans for him were. It was customary then to place a body washed and anointed with oils and spices and wrapped in a linen shroud in a family tomb where it was placed either in a shaft that was cut into the rock, and I've seen many of such, or there would be a shelf that is cut laterally in onto the rock. And that's the most probable case. In Jesus' instance, Jesus' burial was handled probably that way, according to John 20, Mark 15, and Matthew 27. Then after the flesh had decayed, after about a year or so, the bones were gathered, and they were placed into a stone box that was called an ossuary. Now here is one of those kinds of tombs, of which there are a good number. About that era, you will notice that the stone is round, just as the one that was described in the instance of Jesus' burial. It was a round thing that could be rolled in and rolled out. And of course, we know that it was sealed in his case. There was an opening, the body was taken inside, and it was laid on a shelf. And it was laid out there and then was treated with the various unguents. Now here are a number of different instances, for there are very many of them. You'll notice these boxes that are there. These are stone boxes. They're called ossuaries. There are many of such that are in the museums or placed out like this because, you know, what they would do then is take those bones and place them in the boxes after a year. In John chapter 5 in verses 1 to 15, we'll come back to this, by the way. We'll come back to this in a few moments, so we're not going to leave it. Right? Let's talk for a minute about the pools of Jerusalem that are talked about in the Gospel of John and elsewhere. In John 5, Jesus heals a man at the pool of Bethesda. John described the pool as having five porticos or porches. This site had long been in dispute until fairly recently. 40 feet underground. That's a long ways under the ground. Archaeologists discovered a pool with five porticos, precisely the number that are mentioned in the Gospel of John. And the description of the surrounding area matches John's description. In chapter 9, verse 7, John mentions another long disputed site, the so-called Pool of Siloam. However, this pool was also discovered in 1897, again, upholding the accuracy of John. Now, you today can just go there and visit. We actually showed a couple of pictures of one of these pools last night. But I want to show you some more and make some connectivity here. This is what we were talking about, 40 feet underground. You can see down there that there is indeed a series of steps, and down below there was a pool. Here is one of those pools, the Pool of Bethesda, Siloam, that area in general. And then you can see it moves through and ultimately out this side. And today, if you'll notice on the where the archaeologists have been working, this today, I was there just a couple of months ago, and all of that is gone now. It's all where the soil has been removed. And you can see here in this instance, the steps off into the water. The water, this was once a deep pool that is being described in the Bible. So again, the work continues at this point. And then we want to turn to the so-called Simon inscription. Found on the tomb of Absalom in the Kidron Valley in Jerusalem. This is a site that when you go there, your eye is immediately drawn to this particular tomb. You might not recognize it for a tomb, but it is called the Tomb of Absalom in the Kidron Valley. It's unlikely, of course, that Absalom, the son of King David, lies buried in that tomb, which was built hundreds of years after his death, but it may well be that somewhere his grave was underneath that, and that's why when it was built, it actually may mark the site where he was buried. But the inscription declares that the 60-foot high monument is the tomb of Simon, a devout Jew who the Bible says cradled the infant Jesus and recognized him as Messiah. It says, this is the tomb of Zechariah, martyr, very pious priest, father of John. Now, it's unlikely that Simon himself was buried there. The monument is one of several built for Jerusalem's aristocracy at the time of Jesus. But the inscription does go back and back up what until now was very scant reference to a Byzantine era belief that three biblical figures, Simon, as I mentioned, and Zechariah, and James, the brother of Jesus, were all sharing that same tomb. So it is interesting that this may well be the location where James, the brother of Jesus, was actually buried, and certainly Simon and perhaps Zechariah also. As I said, the traditions go back to this location. So actually you've got four people who over time have been attached to this very famous tomb in one way or another, and it may very well be that all four of them at one time or another actually lay there in that location in some way or another, at least for a time. That's what the tomb itself looks like, and that's a figure that maybe you've seen before. It's very well known. And this is the inscription that is found on the outside of it. Here it is in more plain, where you can see with the eye a little bit better. We don't have time to linger over that very much, but the point is that that's the inscription. Now we turn to the so-called bone box of Caiaphas. Construction workers in Jerusalem's water park accidentally found a burial cave. Now this is interesting because in Jerusalem, when you're digging in the ground there, you never know what you're going to, you may hit the jackpot. You may be there to put a phone line in the ground, or you may decide you want to put a water pipe, a sewer pipe, or something like that in the ground. And when you start digging, you have no idea what you're going to get into. And what happens very often is you get to digging, and then you have to stop. You find something, maybe it's human remains, or perhaps it's some artifact, and you see that artifact, you don't have any idea what it is, but you know you need to call. And who are you going to call? Not Ghostbusters. What you're going to do is you're going to call the archaeologists in. And so they make a quick call to the archaeologists, and they come in and they start digging around there, and they very carefully sift it all out and take a very close look at it, and the result of that is that they may find something intriguing, even very important. And that has happened many, many times in the city of Jerusalem. This is one of those times. This one said, when they discovered this bone box, it said, Yehoseph Bar Kapha. Now that doesn't sound very familiar to most of us. But if you speak Hebrew, it's different, because Yehoshaph is the word Joseph, and Bar-Kapha is the name, son of Caiaphas. Caiaphas, why, that's a name you know, isn't it? You've heard that before when you've read your New Testament. According to the ancient Jewish historian Josephus, this was in fact the full name of the high priest who served during Jesus' trial, and then later, if you'll recall, in the book of Acts, threatened the lives of the apostles. Caiaphas, that's him. In the first century, wealthy families, as I mentioned before, would lay the body out, and it would lie there for a year to decompose. After decomposition, they would lovingly gather the bones. They put them in an ossuary. And these boxes were generally 1 1/4 feet wide and about 2.5 feet long. This burial custom, according to archaeologists, is believed to have been limited to a specific era of history, to about a 100-year period, which I might add encompasses the time of Christ. I will tell you this, when they laid Jesus' body out, that was the plan. To let that body lay there for a year and then bring in a bone box a year later and put the bones in it. But it didn't end that way, did it? Well, I'll tell you, for this man, for this particular guy, that's the way it ended up, didn't it? Caiaphas ended up in a box, didn't he? Jesus ended up resurrected. Caiaphas ended up in a bone box. And not only so, but we have his bone box. And you can visit it in the museum, if you would like, there in Jerusalem. Then there's the house of Simon Peter. Somebody says, what? The house of Simon Peter? Yes, indeed. Archaeological excavations carried out over a 70-year period at the beginning of the 20th century by the Studium Biblicum Franciscanum in Jerusalem revealed an octagonal mid-5th century ecclesiastical structure, that means a church structure, around an earlier one-room dwelling dated to the 1st century A.D. You know, the Bible tells us that the Apostle Peter lived in Capernaum, had a house there, and that his wife lived with him in that house. The central octagonal shrine enclosed a drywall basalt structure. And it was surrounded, it was, I might add, no different than the other surrounding houses of the area. A very plain, very common type of a house. Obviously, Simon Peter was just an average Joe, just like the other folks who lived in the city of Capernaum. And there was an octagonal walkway similar to the walkway of the rotunda of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem. We're not talking about Peter's house. We're talking about the church that was built over it. The room contained within the central octagonal shrine appears to have been part of a so-called insula, a complex of small, single-story residential rooms and courtyards. That toward the end of the 1st century was put to public use, possibly as a so-called domus ecclesia, a private house used as a church. The plastered walls of the enshrined room were found to be scratched with graffiti in Aramaic, in Greek, in Syriac, and Latin, containing words like Jesus, and Lord, and Christ, and even Peter. Those names are written on the walls of that building. The enshrined room is presumed to be the so-called House of Simon called Peter, unquote, reported by the Spanish pilgrim, the Lady Egeria, who visited the town sometime between 381 and 384 AD during her pilgrimage, which many Christians made in those days to the Holy Land. She described in some detail how the house of the so-called Prince of the Apostles had been made into a church with its original wall still standing within. In the mid-5th century, this room was enshrined within an octagonal-shaped building, and this was the church that was later described by the 6th century Piacenza pilgrim, who wrote, and I quote, "The house of St. Peter is now a basilica." My guess is that Peter had long since left that area, but the Christians assembled there and worshiped God in that building, and later then a building was built over it, and it was called a church. This is the location. If you see it from the Sea of Galilee, that's what it looks like. That's the covering that's been built over it by those who have donated funds to make that possible. This is what it looks like. This is the archaeological excavation that has been done around it. And you can see the very simple, small rooms of the area, that you're not talking about huge houses or anything like this. And within this area over here, is inside there is the so-called house of St. Peter. And this is the remains of it, not very much. You can see how it's surrounded by expensive walls. Later, Christians gave monies and made it possible for those things to be built. How do we know it's first century? Because the artifacts that are found within are first century artifacts. Here are three cases where these are from that era, the era of the New Testament period. These are the kind of oil lamps that you would have used, with a little wick that went up in this area here, and in all of these instances, a little wick was in there, and it was filled with olive oil, and the oil would burn down, just like the parable says, and you would run out of oil, and you would need to replace it. I want to move now to talk to you a little bit about the Artemis Temple at Ephesus. Another instance. This time we're turning to the book of Acts, turning away from the Gospels for a moment, looking at the book of Acts. Because again, the book of Acts has been down through the years attacked by various historians who say, why, that's not history, it's not real history. It's the sort of thing that as far as they're concerned, is something that's just sort of made up. And down through the years, there have been many attacks upon the reporting that was done by Luke, whom we call the historian, who wrote the book of Acts and also the gospel according to Luke. Architect J.T. Wood, inspired by the story of the silversmiths of the Ephesian goddess Artemis in Acts 19, began a work of excavation in May of 1863, which eventually led to the discovery of the location of the Temple of Artemis. Now, the temple itself obviously no longer exists. It was destroyed. Beneath 25 feet of soil and rubble, Wood's first significant discovery was a magnificent pavement, the basis of colossal pillars and cylinders adorned with sculptures in honor of Artemis. If you visit Ephesus today in Turkey, then what you will see is you will go up to the area where the Basilica of St. John is what it's called. You walk up into the Basilica area where that's at, and you look down over that 25-foot area that's been dug down by the archaeologists. 25 feet of soil is standing over the place where it once stood. And the temple itself, from the remains of the temple, it has been calculated that it was about 343 feet long. It was 164 feet wide, and it contained 100 columns over 6 feet in diameter. During excavation, evidence was unearthed that revealed that the interior of the temple, measuring some 70 feet wide, was lavishly decorated with brilliant colors and gold and silver. The altar, where it was thought the principal statue of Artemis stood behind, was 20 feet square. It was beneath this altar that one of Wood's own countrymen, David G. Hogarth, discovered a large array of statues of the goddess made of bronze and gold and ivory and silver, mind you, silver. 35 years after Wood's initial discovery, it is quite possible that these were the very statues that were crafted by the silversmiths of Artemis, as described by Luke in Acts chapter 19, verses 23 to 41, and about which there was a great riot, if you will recall. They thought that this Paul and his preaching was digging into their prophets, and they needed to get it stopped, but they were unsuccessful in this instance. Now, here is that location, and again, this is taken from up above at the Church of St. John's, and you'll see there's not much left. Frankly, the beautiful stones that stood there were carted off to dozens of different places. In fact, if you look at the construction itself of St. John's Cathedral, you will note that it has a lot of borrowed stone in it, obviously borrowed from the construction of the original site of the Artemisian Temple. And unfortunately, the temple is no longer. All we see there is the base where it once was, and one standing pillar, which wasn't standing. They've just set it on top of it, obviously, so that you could mark it and see where it once was. Here is a statue of Artemis herself. Here is still another picture of another of her statues. And I want to then turn in connection with that to the theater in Acts chapter 19 that is described, wherein you'll recall there was a riot, a great riot that took place. And Luke records how these craftsmen, influenced by Demetrius, who was the head of the local caste of these workers, were led to respond to the threat that Paul's preaching had upon their livelihood. And you'll recall their chant, "Great is Artemis of the Ephesians." Well, there is in existence several ancient inscriptions proving that these particular words were commonly used in the practice of devotion and prayer. Now, that's interesting, because once again, that's what you call sort of a fortuitous, accidental thing that was discovered over the course of the years, and it's not something critical to the story itself. It's not something that when we read it, we say, well, that's true or that's false. We don't know. We just know it's found in the Bible. But in fact, it was found outside the Bible. And that's what's interesting about it, is that it is found outside the Bible. And then we read it in the Bible. Now, isn't that interesting? Because does it not set it in a context of history and not of fantasy? History, reality, and not of fairy tales and empty stories. The great theater where the Ephesian people rioted was situated upon the slope of Mount Pion and capable of holding some 24,500 people. The ruins that can be seen today represents a later reconstruction than what existed in New Testament times, although the basic structure was essentially the same as what existed in Paul's day. And this is what it looked like. And it's most interesting. You can visit it today. You can walk around in it. In fact, I've walked every step of a lot of that area because it's so beautiful and it's just so magisterial to be able to say, this is the same place where that riot took place all those years ago. My point is this anchored in fantasy or is it anchored in real history? Can I really go to that place? Can I really visit that thing? Well, yes, you can. Get a ticket. Go over. City is called Ephesus. It's in Turkey. You can visit it. It's real. It's not imaginary. This is what it looks like. Then there's something called the Erastus inscription. Once again, we're talking about the book of Acts still and the book of 1 and 2 Corinthians. In 1929, among the excavated ruins of ancient Corinth, was discovered an inscription on a marble paving stone bearing the name of a fellow by the name of Erastus. Now, that may have been a fairly common name in the ancient Greek world. The inscription read, and by the way, Erastus is a name which would have been used in a Latin environment as well. And you might note as well that the city of Corinth was a frontier city that was established by the Romans, at least at this particular time in the history, the time when the Apostle Paul visited. And so there is this inscription that reads, Erastus pro edilatate sua pecunia stravit. And I know you're anxious to find out what that says. Well, it says, Erastus, in return for his edileship, laid this pavement at his own expense. This fellow, this Erastus, was a fairly wealthy individual. It mentions the office of ediles in Latin. That was the commissioner of public works, and for this reason, a high-ranking public official belonging to the Roman ruling class, since it was a colonia, or colony of the Romans, and literally a colonia was established by marching a group of soldiers from Rome and then setting up a barracks in a place, and then a city would form around it, just like today things happen. Well, that's one of those places. The Bible calls the city of Philippi such a colonia. And it also, in the course of things, mentions the fact that Corinth was a colony, a Roman colony, also a colonia. And so the one who was an edilis was the commissioner of public works. He was a public official belonging to the Roman ruling class of the city. Paul mentions an Erastus from Corinth in his first letter to the Romans in Romans chapter 16, verse 23. Now, Erastus from Corinth, this inscription was found in Corinth, and I might add to you that you can visit that inscription. It lays in the ground in the city of Corinth, and you can go visit it today. In fact, I was there a couple of months ago and sat and looked at it with my own eyeballs. It's right there. It's physical. It's historical. And it's available so that you can find out whether it really was real or not. This, ladies and gentlemen, in all probability, is the same fellow. Now, he's recognized in the book of Romans in chapter 16, verse 23, as the city treasurer and or as the oikonomos in the Greek, which is not the same as the edilis. But the oikonomos is equivalent to the lesser office called in Latin acarius. If Erastus of Romans 16:23 is to be identified with the man of the inscription, which he most probably is, and usually is assumed to be, I might add, then he was the edilis either before or after Paul wrote his letter. Isn't that an interesting little footnote to the story? Now, here is just a mention of a fellow in Romans 16:23 who was the oikonomos of the city of Corinth. And we go to Corinth and we dig around in the ground and we find an official placard that has this fellow's name upon it. There it is. And if you don't believe it, go and see it, because it's there for you to visit and you can see it. The Theodotus inscription. And I missed my S there. I just noticed that. Where'd that S go? Found on Mount Ophel in Jerusalem in 1913 by Ryman Weil. Now in the Rockefeller Museum in East Jerusalem, you can go and visit it. It is a dedicatory inscription with 10 lines of writing on limestone from the first century AD, that's the biblical period, the New Testament times, in Greek uncial letters. That means they're big letters, they're capital letters, they're called. Theodotus, son of Vetanos, a priest and an archisunagogos, son of an archisunagogos, grandson of an archisunagogos, built the synagogue for the reading of the Torah and for the teaching of the mitzvot, the commandments. Furthermore, the hostel, the rooms, the water installation for lodging needy strangers, its foundation stone was laid by his ancestors, the elders and Simonides. Now, this is interesting. The artifact itself is dated from before the destruction of the temple by the Romans in 70 AD. Presumably, this inscription was attached to a synagogue building in Jerusalem, a dedicatory inscription when they built it. The inscription indicates that the synagogue built by Theodotus was not only intended as a place of learning Torah, but also served as a place for the lodging of visitors to Jerusalem for times like the Passover feast or other major pilgrim festivals. Notice the reference to the ruler of the synagogue, archisunagogos, a term that is very strange, but is found in Mark 5, 22, 35 and 36, Luke 8, 49, Luke 13, 14, Acts 13, 15, Acts 18, 8, and Acts 18, 70. The point being, this word is frequently found in the Bible regarding someone who is the ruler of a synagogue. Never found in the Old Testament, but apparently something that existed in New Testament times and doesn't exist today, I might add. Something that existed then in New Testament times is mentioned in the Gospels, is mentioned in the book of Acts, and then pretty much fades away in history after that. Interesting. But is it not incidental to the, you can see, probably even read the word Theodotus, that right there. Theodotus. The point being that here you have an inscription on a New Testament period synagogue that stood probably in the days of Jesus and the apostles. Now I want to turn now to the so-called Lysanias inscription. In Luke's announcement of Jesus' public ministry in Luke 3 and 1, he mentions one Lysanias, the tetrarch of Abilene. Now I'm pronouncing it like the Greek does. Scholars question Luke's credibility, since the only Lysanias known for centuries was a ruler of Chalcis who ruled from 40 to 36 BC, which was too early for New Testament times. However, an inscription dating to the time of Tiberius, which is biblical times, New Testament times, who ruled from 14 to 37 AD, right through the time of Jesus, was found recording a temple dedication which names one Lysanias as the tetrarch of Abila, Abilene in Greek, near Damascus. This matches very well with Luke's account, and so fits exactly what one would expect if we're talking about real history and the incidental little things that occur that point to that. Let me turn to the Gallio inscription, it's called. In Acts 18, verses 12 to 17, Paul was brought before one Gallio, who is called in this case the proconsul of Achaia. Luke calls him by his official title, which is precisely correct. Once again, archaeology confirms the seemingly unimportant details of this account. He governed over Achaia and was also known as the brother of Seneca, a very well-known and famous Roman philosopher, and the tutor to the Caesar Nero. I'll get it out here in a minute. At Delphi, an inscription of a letter from Emperor Claudius was discovered. In it he states, "Lucius Junius Gallio, my friend, and the proconsul of Achaia." Historians date the inscription to 52 AD, which corresponds almost precisely to the time of the apostle's stay in 51 AD. Interesting. The word proconsul meant governor of a Roman province, which was administered by the Senate in Rome, as opposed to one who is a procurator, like Pontius Pilate, if you recall. It simply meant an agent of the emperor, which was a much inferior class of officials. Achaia was a senatorial province from 27 BC to AD 15, and also from AD 44 and onward. It is particularly interesting to note that Luke accurately calls Gallio by his official title, proconsul of Achaia, which earlier would not have been his name, and much later would not have been his name either. By doing this, Luke departs from his usual custom of calling countries by their general titles. Instead of returning to the province of Achaia by the more ordinary name of Greece, he does not call Gallio the proconsul of Greece, but of Achaia, which is interesting, but very, very accurate. Perfectly accurate, in fact. Only one who was there at the time could know that. And that's the interesting part of it. This is a picture of Delphi, where it was discovered. Now, the title first man, given to one Publius in Acts 28, verse 7. Luke gives him this title. Oproton is the name that's given him. The chief man of the island of Malta. The first man of the idol. Scholars questioned this strange title and deemed it unhistorical and inaccurate. Inscriptions have recently been discovered on the island itself of Malta that indeed gives Publius the title first man, Oproton, exactly what the Bible describes him as. This is Malta, and you can visit there today and see in the museum some of these inscriptions if you would like to visit. It's a beautiful place and well worth your time spent. The Politarch at Thessalonica, another seemingly strange title given to a local leader in the book of Acts regarding people in the city of Thessalonica. Luke uses this word in chapter 17, verse 6. As a title for civil authorities in Thessalonica, and it was thought at first to be surely inaccurate, since the word was not known to exist in all of classical Greek literature. However, again, more recent discoveries made by archaeologists have shown that Luke was perfectly accurate in his use of this word. Since some 19 inscriptions have been discovered that make use of precisely this title, five of which are used in specific reference to the city of Thessalonica. Now, isn't that interesting? But again, something you would expect after you have studied this for a while. In 1835, one Greek inscription was discovered on an arch at Thessalonica, which contained the title Politarch. The arch itself was destroyed in 1867. But the inscription is now in the British Museum. This is something like what that arch would have looked like originally, because such arches are found in various places. Now, that brings us back where we started tonight. Remember where we started? We're asking ourselves, archaeology, why doesn't that deal with real history? Now, things like fables and myths and legends and fictional tales, they do not leave behind them any what we would call material remains to establish their accuracy or their reality. Well, what do these things then tell me about the nature of the biblical material? Am I dealing with fables, with myths, with legends, or am I talking here about real stories of real history? And I think there's only one answer to that. And we see it consistently in regard to the Old Testament materials and in regard to the New Testament materials. In seeming accidental, small, tiny little material evidences, in inscriptions, on pavements, on monuments, and a host of other things, in ancient documents, which again attest the veracity, the basic veracity. And if I could just study and find several things about a story to know that they are actual real history, and that that is the setting of that story, then would that not give me some evidence that I'm dealing with reality? In fact, that's exactly the conclusion that we're drawn to. In fact, most who are really objective on the matter are led there and only there. And in fact, honestly, I believe that if you're going to go somewhere else, there's something else tugging at your clothing. There's something else taking you in that direction. It may be a host of things. It may be that you have great respect for certain, or admiration for certain teachers or professors or that sort of thing. And it may be that there's an undercurrent in your heart and in your mind and in your life that is leading you to worldliness. There's the tug of the world. And this disbelief that you may entertain regarding the biblical narratives and the biblical documents is really more the world tugging at you and not really the evidence pushing you there. And that's what you really have to examine. Because so often, as I've seen people pulled away from the church and pulled away from the faith, there's something going on beneath, inside the heart, inside the mind. There are things I want to do, and I know that if I stay with the church, I can't do the practices, or there are people or whatever that I want, and I can't have them if I stay with the church. And so let's just be honest with ourselves. Let's be frank and straightforward, straight from the chest. What's really pulling me? What's really taking me away? It's not the evidence. It's not that the Bible is unbelievable. The Bible is believable. It's not that the Bible is unhistorical. It is historical. It's that something else is pulling me away. Don't let it do that. We're talking about eternal matters. We're talking about heaven and hell and God and Satan. And all of those are real. Believe me, they are. 10 seconds after you've closed your eyes in death, you know how real they are. So don't be drawn away. If you're with us tonight and you need to obey the gospel, let the gospel appeal to you. Let it draw you, because it's worthy. The Christ, who is the center of all that we believe and all that we stand for and all that we hope for, he's real. And everything the Bible says about him is true. And someday we'll stand before him, and we'll stand before his great white throne, and all the dead will living and the dead. And the Bible says the books will be opened, and another book will be opened, which is the book of life. And then we'll be judged, everyone, according to what we have done, whether they be good or whether they be evil. Are you prepared for that moment? I can tell you, if you allow the world to call you away, if you allow the world to drag you away, you won't be ready. And so let me urge you tonight, get ready. Make that preparation. Do it tonight while we stand and together sing.